Welcome to the Cello Sherpa podcast, where we explore all aspects of the climb to the summit, from intermediate musician to the professional stage. Check us out online at thecellosherpa.com or follow us on Twitter and Instagram at thecellosherpa. I'm Joel Dallow, your host. I joined the cello section of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra in 1999 and founded the Riverside Chamber Players based in Roswell, Georgia in 2003. Today's episode is sponsored by Clear Resources, your premier resource for compliance, legal, ethics, and risk. For more information, visit them online at clearresources.com. Today's guest is Anthony Arnone, who is Associate Professor of Cello at the University of Iowa School of Music and is also on the faculty of the Prusel School of Music in Iowa City, where he teaches and conducts. In the fall of 2020, he released his book, The Art of Listening, where he interviews 13 of the top cello teachers of our time, sharing valuable insights about performing, teaching, music, and life. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
Pleasure to be here today, Joel.
So I was lucky enough to travel to Hawaii last fall, but it was unfortunately cut short due to some health problems I suffered. However, I'll be returning this fall to finish what I started, and I absolutely fell in love with it. So you were actually lucky enough to be born in Hawaii, which I refer to as paradise. So I'm fascinated to hear about what it was like to grow up in Hawaii and where you found your musical inspiration to pursue the cello.
Great question. And before I answer that, I just want to thank you for having me on your podcast. I've really enjoyed all the episodes, and I'm just really honored to get to be another episode. And I'm really excited about this. So thank you for that.
Thank you for saying so. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, it's very meaningful to me. And yes, I did grow up in paradise, as you put it. Although I always tell people I never appreciated it until I left. In fact, I was often frustrated that I didn't get to wear cool winter coats or sweaters or see fall leaves change or snow or any of those things. The weather was predictably beautiful year round. But with that said, certainly now in my life, I love the fact that I still have reason to go there with family members and friends. And it is one of my favorite places on the planet to go visit. Musically, I was very lucky that I went to, I think, one of the two best private schools in Hawaii. There's Punahou, which is where my sister went and where Obama went.
Oh, okay.
And they were there about the same time, in the 1 year apart. But I went to the rival school called Iolani School. And Iolani and Punahou are both fantastic schools with a lot of different things to offer, a high academic level. But for me, I got to start the cello there. Mm-hmm. And I started in seventh grade beginning orchestra. And sort of randomly on the cello, it was where some of my friends were sitting, and I didn't know what I wanted to play. So I just kind of went over to be with my friends. But I was very lucky to have a nice program in what would be junior high and high school at the school to get acquainted with the cello and classical music. And there was also a really wonderful youth symphony, and still is, in Hawaii. So very fortunate to have that experience growing up as well. But I think like music can be for a lot of kids, it was more of a social thing for me. At that point,
yeah,
just getting to hang out with my friends. And I certainly enjoyed the music, enjoyed the experience of being in an orchestra and being surrounded by those sounds. But I'd say more than that, it was getting to be around people that I like to hang out with. And in fact, one of the biggest influences for me was a friend who was from China, a violinist, and we got to be good friends. And that was my first introduction to chamber music, was through him.
Hmm.
We actually discovered the Brahms B major trio parts at my school. And one night we stayed up at my house till probably 1 a.m, just kind of reading through them until my mom came in and told us to go to sleep. And this person now is in the Boston Symphony. He's been in there a long time. He was definitely one of the friends that also inspired me musically to realize what you could do on an instrument, which I hadn't really realized until I hung out with him.
Yeah.
Among others.
So how old were you when you started taking private lessons then?
I was 16 when I started taking private lessons. My orchestra teacher said, you know, you seem pretty good at this cello thing. You might want to get some private instruction at some point. And eventually I did that, which was obviously very helpful, but I didn't have the bug yet, you know, this real desire to be a cellist until I went off to college. So I started school at the University of Washington as a psych major.
Oh, okay.
And enjoying cello and happy that there was a teacher there. And my pivotal summer was, I think it was my first summer after going to University of Washington. I worked up on a processing barge in Alaska cleaning salmon.
Ooh.
And I could not bring my cello or very much of anything except a duffel bag of clothes. And I really missed the cello. And I came back and I kind of, from that summer, made the decision like, you know what? I think I want to try this and we'll see what happens. But I didn't ever want to look back when I was like my age now and think, I wonder if I could have been a cellist. And so that summer really steered me into pursuing music with everything.
Wow, that's a really uncommon story, actually, to start private lessons at 16, which is 10 years later than I started. And then to end up pursuing that and being successful down that path is really, that's impressive. It sounds like a pretty late start compared to most of our guests on this show.
I think so. The advantage I had that I often tell my students about too, though, is that I think a lot of people that start younger don't necessarily know, like from their heart, that's what they want to do. They've just maybe always been good at it and maybe enjoyed it. But when I eventually went to New England Conservatory, I felt like I had a lot of catching up to do.
Yeah.
But I was incredibly motivated and curious about the cello and practiced a lot and had just soaked in information from everyone around me. And I also saw a lot of people that I think were re-examining their desire to play the instrument as they became a young adults and to think, is this really what I want to do?
Yeah.
I feel lucky that, you know, if my parents had been musicians, which they're not, I don't think I would have gone into music because I would have wanted to do my own thing. But somehow it was helpful for me to find this thing that was my own and get to see where that led me without any pressure from family or friends.
Yeah. And I imagine we all know that the music community is extremely small. If you run into people from when you were an early teenager on, they can be on audition committees when you go take an orchestra audition somewhere later on. But I imagine it must have been really small in the island of Oahu compared to what the rest of us are used to.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I certainly know the handful of cellists that have gone on to be professional cellists from Hawaii. And there's a couple of us, but like I said earlier, I just feel really lucky that the school system in Hawaii was so conducive to getting exposed to and learning these instruments well. So I feel always very lucky to have that experience.
Yeah, that's really great. Well, it appears that you and I share the same mission, only I chose to do it through the podcast medium, and you chose to sit down and interview 13 legendary teachers and then publish a book of those interviews. How did this project come about?
It's a great question, and it's sort of a 3 or 4 part answer, I think, because these things just don't happen all at once. But the first segment of how this happened was probably, I think, around 2004, 2005. One of my former teachers, Bonnie Hampton, was visiting. I do a yearly event I call Cello Days, in which I bring in a couple famous people and then have a cello choir of usually about 50 or so cellists. It could be ages, you know, 8 or 9 into 80 years old, the community people, high school, college, adult amateurs, things like that. Anyway, so Bonnie was here as a guest for that. And we were just hanging out one night. And, you know, I was excited because I never got to hang out with Bonnie. I studied with her a little bit, but here we were drinking an adult beverage one evening and talking about her life. And she started talking about her lessons with Pablo Casals. Oh. And I just have this vivid memory of sort of looking around thinking, I should be recording this.
Yeah,
because these stories are incredible. And someone should capture these stories of what it was like to study, you know, with people like Pablo Casals. So then the next sort of chunk of the story is that I read shortly after a book, I think it was called Conversations with Conductors or Conductors in Conversation. And I don't remember this woman's name, but she interviewed probably 10 or 12 of pretty famous conductors and asked them all basically the same questions about first rehearsals and score study and Beethoven's metronome markings and all kinds of different things. But I love the idea that you could compare how these people felt about specific issues.
Yeah.
And that fascinated me. So then I kind of started to get this idea together, like, wow, it'd be really interesting to maybe interview a bunch of people like Bonnie Hampton and ask them the same questions. And then I think just from teaching a number of years here in Iowa and finding young, talented students, but many of them had never heard of any of the people in my book, or, you know, they don't know these names. And of course, there's no reason why they should.
Yeah.
They're not born knowing this stuff. That someone needs to expose them to it. And I just remember thinking, you know, I should dedicate a component of my teaching or my seminar class to having them learn about these great names, because cello playing is something that's passed on verbally. So much of it, it's like an apprenticeship in a way. And so they should know their lineage and where, you know, who these names are and who they studied with. So that was kind of, everything was sort of in place. to get going on this, but I'll tell you the story, especially because I just saw him this weekend. But usually there's a tipping point, mm-hmm. you know, that for a project like this, because I mean, to be honest, it kind of freaked me out. I'd never written a book before. And, you know, I like to push myself, get out of my comfort zone, but this seemed almost like, I don't know if I can do this. We have a quartet residency program here where quartets visit the university for a week or 10 days. And there's a cellist named Felix Umansky, who's currently in the Harlem String Quartet. Uh-huh. And he was in another quartet at the time, but they were here doing their residency and there was an after concert cocktail thing. And I was chatting with them just casually. And I mentioned this idea, you know, this rough idea I had. And he said to me, "That's a great idea. I would definitely read that book. If mm-hmm. I hope you do it someday." I remember leaving that night just going, wow, Felix just said, you know, it's like affirmation that this would be a good thing. And that's what actually got the ball rolling. And I ran into him the other night, they were back visiting. And I said, "Felix, I have to tell you this, you were the tipping point for me getting this book started. So thank you for that." And he was very appreciative of that. And we had a nice conversation. So it's, you know, big projects like this, it takes a bunch of little tremors to get the final earthquake happening, I think.
Yeah. So the original conversation that you had with your teacher, Bonnie Hampton, did you record that? And was that the conversation you used for the book, or was it a later conversation?
It was a later conversation, because I think that night I didn't have a recording device close by, and it was more of like, I wish I could have recorded that. But ultimately I did, with all of these people, I had a fancy recording device with me, so I didn't have to take notes or anything. And I got to go spend, I mean, with Bonnie, I think it was 5 or 6 hours straight.
Wow.
Like we're doing now, except 5 hours plus. And it was so rewarding. I think I mentioned earlier, because she was my teacher at one point, and I didn't really get to know her as a person. And so I just loved getting to find out all about her life.
Yeah.
And what was very touching to me was, after we were done, it's just 5 hours, an afternoon at her house in Berkeley, she said to me, "Well, now let me take you out to dinner and I can ask you some questions." So she wasn't sick of me after that point. And, you know, we'd had a pleasant dinner and I got to just tell her a little bit about my life, catch her up a little bit.
Did you happen to keep track of how long it took you from start to finish to start the interviews, go through all the interviews, then write the book and then release the book? Do you know how many years were involved in that project?
Yeah, I think it was something close to 3 years.
Wow. Yeah, that's quite an investment.
And, you know, I tell you, and I've told other people this too, especially people that are trying to do projects they maybe haven't done, because I was, again, nervous that I didn't know if I would ever reach the finish line, but I kept trying to do one more little thing to bring me closer.
Yeah.
That was always my goal. Though, don't try to think too far ahead, just do this thing. And I know I need to do it to finish the book. So if I just keep doing these little things, eventually I'm going to work my way to the finish.
You know, it's not unlike learning an instrument, or for that matter, learning a foreign language. I always compare the two, because the knowledge builds upon itself over time. And sometimes it's really hard to see where the journey is going. But if you take those small steps along the way, you're on the path, on that journey. Do you think that learning how to play the cello and that process helped you learn how to do that with the book? Also, were you able to apply the same skill set?
I think so. Although my mind immediately went to, when you said that I was, I think, a very good interviewer to these people because of my cello background, too. You know, all these people have been interviewed before, but I think a lot of times they're interviewed by people that aren't cellists and classical musicians. And so, I mean, I think yes to what you first asked me about, that definitely helped. Some of the funnest parts of the interviews were getting off on tangents,
yeah,
you know, which I could see you and I doing too. And just because of my curious mind and my cello mind, I was able to kind of go down roads that I remember thinking, well, we're probably not going to use this for the book, but boy, this is really good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel that way too. It's the curiosity that keeps me doing this, because I'm very curious, not just about musicians, but just about the people that I get to interview. I'm always curious about other things also. So conversations can go in many different directions outside of music also. But I think it's really interesting too, what you said, because I'm not sure that everybody realizes this, especially if you're not a musician and you're listening to this podcast, that what we do really is passed down verbally from generation to generation. So it's this family tree. I mean, there are books written about it, but this is when you learn an instrument with somebody week after week, it's that cumulative effect, week, months to years, that you're learning what they learned and their experiences. And that's also why I love doing this podcast, because it's an opportunity to have anybody come on here and share their experience with anybody else. And that's not something you get unless you're studying with some of these teachers. So I think it's really cool.
That's true. Let me add one more comment to that if I can, because my sister was blown away by this. My sister teaches junior high math, but I told her, you know, her name's Michelle. I said, Michelle, I was not trained to be a teacher at all. When you go to music schools, and people who are listening to this who aren't musicians might be curious to know this, I didn't take one teaching class in my life. I studied with these great people. I got hired at the University of Iowa, and I'm passing on, I mean, I put my own spin on it, hopefully, but it's just fascinating to me that we are put in a teacher role without actually really being trained to teach.
That is so true.
And it's really, like you said, we're passing down this information that we got from, you know, my teacher, Colin Carr, Bonnie Hampton, who got it from William Pleath and Casals, who got it from, you know, it's just, and that kind of scares me sometimes. It took me, I'm sure, several hundred hours of teaching to really kind of find my teaching flow.
Oh, for sure.
So I feel bad for my early students that had to put up with that.
But I know I started on beginners for that reason. It really taught me how to teach, how to explain and break things down for that reason. But so it's interesting too, because a significant percentage of professional cellists working today studied with either Pablo Casals, Gregor Piatigorsky, and Leonard Rose, or with their students. And actually, my biggest influences on the cello happen to also be students of Piatigorsky and Leonard Rose. So were all of the teachers that you interviewed students of those three, or are there any outliers in the group?
There are a number of outliers, and I don't know if this is a good time to list the people in the book.
Go
I know
for
that
it.
Was something.
Yeah, that would be great.
And I can kind of give you some of their teacher highlights, too. So, yeah, in alphabetical order, Richard Aaron, who studied with Raya Garbusova and David Wells, and Colin Carr, who studied with Gendron and Pleath. Uh-huh. Steve Doan, who studied with Kapuscinski, Greenhouse, and Jane Cohen. Jane Cohen's another, just that's a whole other podcast, I think, interesting story. But Greenhouse is certainly one of the names that came up more than once here. Tim Eddy studied also with Luigi Silva and Greenhouse, Bernard Greenhouse. Stephen Gaber, who's in the book, studied with Gabor Raito, Stephen Deke, Ron Leonard, Zara Nelsova. Bonnie Hampton, who was mentioned earlier, with Margaret Rowell, Zara Nelsova, and Pablo Casals. Gary Hoffman studied with Starker. Hans Jensen, Leonard Rose, Channing Robbins, and Fournier. Paul Katz, who's great. He always says, I have the best teachers in the world, so if I don't play well, certainly not because I didn't have good teachers. But he studied with Piatigorsky, Starker, Greenhouse, Rose, and Raito.
Wow.
Amazing group of teachers.
Yes.
Ron Leonard studied with Samuel Mays and Leonard Rose. Larry Lesser studied with Casado and Piatigorsky. So there's still some overlap. Raphael Walfish with Piatigorsky and Helga Winold with Starker. So, you know, there is probably a bigger consensus of people studying with Starker and Rose. And who else did you mention? But the teachers that you mentioned. But
Casals.
Casals, that's right. But really, a lot of other names popped in there too. Which was really exciting for me because I had heard of these names, but to get to hear their take on how they were as teachers was fascinating for me.
And how did you pick these lucky 13?
Yeah, it's a good question. Some of them were my former teachers, so that part in a way was easy. And many of them were just people that I was influenced by, could be recordings or just watching masterclasses or having friends that studied with them. I mean, like Paul Katz. You know, I got to tell Paul Katz, thank you for introducing me to the Beethoven quartets when I was younger, you know, because it was Cleveland Quartet recordings that I got to hear. So he seemed like a no-brainer to me. Or Tim Eddy was someone who I auditioned for a couple of times and didn't get in, and who I just have a lot of respect for and admiration. And so there were some obvious names. And then I asked some of my friends and colleagues, you know, am I missing anyone? And I get asked sometimes, well, what about this person? You could have had this person. And it's certainly a slippery slope in a way that there's obviously more people I could have interviewed. But at some point, I mean, you've seen the book probably. It's long enough that I just felt like this was a good number. And actually, I had Joel Krosnick was on the list, but, and that's a story maybe I can share later, that chapter did not work out, sadly, because he was fascinating too and such an inspiration to me in my life for various reasons.
Yeah.
So it wasn't always smooth sailing with that every chapter. And some of these people I knew fairly well, and some of them I had never met before. And that was part of the journey that was exciting for me as well.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite person that you interviewed of that group?
That's such a hard one to answer. But what comes to mind are two, that Bonnie Hampton, I probably because I got to study with her and I knew her before, and I really didn't know about her story of her life. And they're all incredible, but just the journey she had, especially as a woman in a time where it was a lot harder to be successful as a woman, as we know from orchestras and teachers and all that. So she just forged her own path. And I just loved hearing every part of her journey. So that was really inspiring to me. And then the other one probably was Gary Hoffman, who I hadn't met before. I interviewed him at Ravinia, and he was a little hard to get to know at first, and understandably so, because he didn't know me as this guy showing up to interview him. But and we had interview in several chunks, but the last chunk was several hours at night at Ravinia, just in one of the practice rooms. And he really opened up, and I just found him to be such a thinker and inspiring creative mind. And again, I feel bad saying that because they're all these people are pretty elite, pretty incredible. But he struck me, just he touched a nerve in me that was really meaningful.
Yeah.
When I do lectures on this book and like to share some examples, there's several of his that I always come to the fore because I just love how he speaks about life and relating to music especially.
Can you share then, after sitting down with all of these teachers, who maybe inspired you the most in your own teaching, or some of the things that you picked up from these interviews that you have put into your own teaching style?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I learned a lot. I think one of my strengths as a teacher is that usually I'm able to retain a lot of the information that I hear, and can my filing cabinet stays pretty available, which is, has been great. So an example would be, I think I was asking Gary Hoffman about intonation. How does he teach intonation? That's something I asked them all about. And he said, I want it to become their problem. So when it's their problem, it's not my problem anymore, which makes sense, you know? And so I, of course, immediately used that in my teaching, but I actually used it in other ways too. Like if someone has a tight vibrato, let's just say, if it becomes their problem, then they're going to want to really do something about it. If it's not bugging them, then it's harder to change.
Yeah.
But when they hear it and go, ooh, yeah, I don't want this sound, then I've passed it to them and they're going to, I can give them tools hopefully to help, but they are going to want to fix it. So I just love that idea as part of a teaching philosophy, as having the students, in essence, have it become their problem, something that they realize they need to change and want to find a way to do that.
Yeah. I like that too. That's a great point.
Yeah. I could share a lot more, but I'll maybe just pick one more or two that came to mind. With Hans Jensen, and because I asked all of them, how do you pick your students? I think I worded it as, do you pick someone that maybe has a lot to say, but physically might have some challenges? Or do you want someone that's physically really gifted on the cello and you can help them become a stronger musician? And there were all sorts of different answers to that. But Hans Jensen said, I pick people that want to study with me. And I kind of laughed like you did. I mean, it's like I said, Hans, everyone wants to study with you. And he said, no, I really, really want someone that really believes in me, that trusts me, and that is going to, in it, I'm paraphrasing, but it's sort of give themselves to me to let me do what I can for them. And I hadn't really thought of that before, that slice of a teacher, a student relationship. I mean, I, of course, deal with it every day, but for him to realize how important that is when he's picking people.
Yeah.
That he really wants to make sure that they have that connection and he respects them so much. You probably know him. He's just the most enthusiastic, committed teacher there is, I think. So for him to value that in the people that he's hearing just really resonated with me.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to interview him last season. It was a wonderful interview. He's such a high energy, positive person. It was really a joy to meet him and get to interview him because I've sent some students to him too.
Okay.
Well, let's talk then about your program at Iowa, because I would ask you the same thing. What kind of program is it? What kind of students would most benefit from being in the program that you are a part of? And what do you look for in your students?
Great question. I'll try to answer that in order. I think the thing I'm most proud of about the cello studio at the University of Iowa is that it's a whole range of directions in life, abilities, final results that they're looking for. You know, in other words, not everyone is there to try to get an orchestra job or to be a teacher, that there are people that are trying to use the cello to do unconventional things with the cello. There are people that want to be music therapy majors. There are people that do want that. Someone auditioning for the Milwaukee Symphony in a month or two. There are people that come from all sorts of different places and backgrounds. Some Midwest people, a lot of people from Asia or Europe sometimes. And I love the feeling in my studio that I wouldn't say it's competitive. It's very supportive, mm-hmm. sort of a family feeling. And I'd like to think that I help nurture that.
Yeah.
That they can feel that that's important for me when I walk in the room. And I am careful to make sure that everyone has an opinion that's respected and valued, and that we can all learn from each other, which is something that I always remember at NEC. I think I learned as much from all the other students as I did from my teachers too.
Absolutely.
Just getting to hear these people play. Wow. The way they are shifting. How are they shifting like that? I wanted to be able to do that and to just get to watch them. So as far as my studio, I mean, the other thing that you may or may not know this, but Iowa, Cedar Rapids and Iowa City and a few other places had horrible floods. And I think it was 2008. Mm-hmm. And it destroyed 17 university buildings here in Cedar Rapids. The downtown Cedar Rapids, like a square mile, was flooded and many buildings really damaged. But we have an incredible new facility because of that. We had to wait about another 8 years after the flood, but we have an incredible music building. If anyone's listening to this, just go to YouTube and put in Voxman Music Building mm-hmm. and you'll get a little tour. And everyone that comes here is like, wow, this is one of the nicest facilities in the country. So my view out my window is incredible. The building is so open and well designed. I think it won an architectural award from the company that in Seattle that designed this. And it's just a pleasure to walk in the building every day and be here.
Yeah, to have something horrible turn into something great. That's the
exactly.
best story. Yeah.
Yeah, because we were homeless for about 6 or 7 years, I think. And that was very hard on the music school.
Yeah.
People, they obviously want good teachers and good orchestra program and all of that, but they also want to be in a place that they're feeling happy and comfortable. So,
yeah. So how many students do you have in your studio?
I think right now I have 15, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
We have a doctoral program, master's students and undergrads. And like I said, we have one of the best music therapy programs in the country here. Mm-hmm. So I have a couple of music therapy majors, some education majors, performance majors. And again, people that have all kinds of different goals in mind.
Yeah. And then do students usually come to you ahead of that audition to meet with you and take a lesson with you and see what your teaching style is like? Maybe before they even come audition for the school, do you do trial lessons in that way?
Yeah, definitely. In fact, just before I visited you, I'm in my office now, but I was at home doing a Zoom lesson with a prospective student from Tucson, I think, in Arizona.
Okay, great.
And yeah, I always try. I mean, the blessing of the pandemic is how easy things are to be virtual now these days. And even though the sound is never ideal, but yeah, I will very often encourage students to get together for a lesson. And I tell them it's more important for me to see how we interact and how they might respond and to an idea and how that goes. An audition is so dry and formal, and I would much rather get to spend time getting to know the person and know how they respond to ideas and if they're pleasant to be around or not, things like that.
Yeah. So then that brings me to the other part of my question before is, what do you look for in a student?
I look for potential is too easy a word, but we talked earlier that I started pretty late. And when I first played for my teacher at the University of Washington, when I was 18, she was kind of dismissive with me. And she later regretted that, I think, but she didn't maybe realize how short a time I had been playing or the progress that I could make. And so I always remember that because I'll hear a lot of times people that especially coming in for undergrad that aren't that advanced. Mm-hmm. But I remind myself, I wasn't very advanced either.
Yeah.
And so I look for, certainly if they're trying to say something that's coming out in spite of maybe some physical limitations, but if they have a voice that you can just feel, and too, from being a musician, you can feel that in someone's playing, even if they're restricted in some ways.
Yeah.
And I look for a passion and curiosity that they really seem excited about this, because again, as they're going to have to really dedicate a lot of hours to figuring out how the instrument works, how your body works over the coming years. So if someone doesn't have that, then that's going to be a problem in the future.
For sure. Well, is there anything else you'd like to share with our audience that we might have missed?
Just say that this book, I don't really feel like I wrote it. I curated it, maybe more than anything. I organized it. So I don't want to take credit for that, but it is, I think, the thing I'm most proud of that I've done in my music career. And I'm really hoping that it will be around for many years after I'm long gone And that there's this sort of timestamp in this book too, in a sense that maybe in, you know, 200 years, there might be some young cellists going, I wonder what cello life was back way back in the early 2000s, or, you know, and maybe having vaguely heard of some of these names. And that was my goal with this. And I always told people, like, I was on these highs after the interviews. I mean, it was such an exhilarating experience to sit and talk with these people. These were my idols when I was in school. And I just wanted to do these interviews justice. And the feedback has been very encouraging. And I'm just pleased that I reached the finish line. And I just think there's so much information for especially cellists, but other string players even, to take in and apply. And again, I didn't write it. I just gathered it. But I was very lucky. I maybe leave it at that. I was lucky to get to learn, basically have lessons without my cello for all these people.
Yeah.
It's incredibly important.
Well, it's a wonderful book, and it's so great that you were willing to do this. And I share that same passion with you. I think there's a point where many of us get in our career where we want to leave some sort of legacy behind that's hopefully helpful for the next generation that's coming up behind us, because this is a very challenging profession and everybody should be able to get all the help that they can. And we have access to so much more information today than we did 10, 15, 20 years ago. So each of these years that go by, there's more and more tools out there that people can use to continue to try and be successful. And hopefully it'll be easier for them in that way. Mm-hmm. And where can people find this book?
Oh, pretty much anywhere you can buy books. I mean, Amazon or barnesandnoble.com, or just, it's pretty easy to find.
Okay.
People can always write me. They can find me at the University of Iowa if they need some help. Happy to do that too.
Well, I'll include any links in the show notes so people can find things easier and how to get in touch with you.
Okay, wonderful.
And find you online. Well, thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
Thank you, Joel. It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much to Anthony Arnone for joining us today and sharing his book with us. And thank you for listening to another episode of the Cello Sherpa podcast. For more information on Anthony and any of the links we spoke about today, check out our show notes by scrolling down on the episode. Be sure and catch our next episode where we interview Carter Bray, who has been the principal cellist of the New York Philharmonic since 1996. We talk about his experience as both a soloist and a principal cellist and what qualities are required for exceptional leadership. We're here to serve you. So if you have questions or topic suggestions you would like to cover in future episodes, please use the contact page on our website, thecellosherpa.com, or tweet them at us at thecellosherpa. You will also find information about the specific services we offer on the website. Don't forget to follow us and rate us on whatever platform you get your podcasts. This helps us climb the rankings so other people can find us. Today's episode was produced, edited, and recorded by me, Joel Dallow.